Popcorn Gonzetta, a fantastic example of what can be seen through initiative. Though English was his third language, his success is primarily attributed to his ability to encapsulate complex ideas and present them in concise, compelling fashion. He was best known for his oft-repeated description of Coke's infinite growth potential. Each of the 6 billion people on this planet drinks an average of 64 ounces of fluids daily, of which only 2 ounces are Coca-Cola. Coke's employees were blown away by the originality and the audacity of the idea when their leader first spoke of it. Eventually, closing the 62 gap became a centerpiece of inspiration and motivation within the company. The idea of closing the 62 gap was a clear, simple, and easily repeatable message that could be used to communicate change. And the message didn't weaken in power as it was repeated to others. Number 3, build in time for people to process ideas. If you're working with people in a formal environment, such as board meetings, you need to give them time to accept change. And one of the best ways to do that is to develop a meeting agenda that creates processing time for them. For many years, I used the following format with my board of directors. Information items. I began with items of interest to the people attending the meeting. Typically, these were positive items that boosted morale and started the meeting off on a high energy level. Study items. These were issues that we would need to discuss, but not vote on. Introducing such items one or more meetings ahead of the time of decision-making allowed everyone to share ideas or ask questions without the pressure of advocating a particular point of view. If a study item involved a major change, I often kept it in this category for several meetings until everyone had time to process through the issues and come to agreement. Action items. I put items in this section only if they had been previously listed as study items. We had discussed, we had processed them thoroughly, and I was certain that everyone was ready to make a positive decision on them. By the time most leaders have recognized the need for change, analyzed the problems and possible solution, and strategized the plan to implement it, they are ready for action. But trying to take action before the key people accept the change leads to disaster. My friend Norwood Davis, CFO of the John Maxwell Company, summed it up with a formula that he recently shared with me. E equal Q time A. That stands for effectiveness equals quality times acceptance. And as Norwood reminded me, if you multiply an idea with a quality value of 10, but it has a zero acceptance rate, its effectiveness will still equal zero. Acceptance is the key to getting results as a leader. The letter H stands for head into action. Once you have the buy-in of the key players, the change train can finally leave the station and start moving. Of course, that doesn't mean everyone will be on board. To paraphrase an observation by former Senator Robert Kennedy, 20% of the people are against everything, 100% of the time. But you can't wait for everyone. If you have the influence and the people who will execute the change, you have enough to get started, and many others will get on board in time. Often I hear people say, vision unites people. I disagree. Vision divides people. It separates the people who will from the ones who won't. And that's a good thing. When you start heading into action, people get off the fence, and you find out who's who. You never know the level of your people's commitment until you call them to action. You want to enlist the committed people to help you. How do you know the likelihood that people will join you? You need to take stock of your personal influence. Every leader has a certain amount of change in his or her pocket. By that I mean emotional support, in the form of bargaining chips. Every time the leader does something positive, it increases the amount of change he possesses. Anytime a leader does something that's perceived as negative, it weakens the relationship and costs the leader some of the change in his pocket. If a leader keeps doing things that weaken the relationships, it's possible for him to become bankrupt with his people. Always remember, it takes change to make change. And the more change you have in your pocket, the more changes you can make in the lives of people. The less change, the harder it is to move into action. The letter E, expect problems. Anytime anyone initiates any kind of movement, problems arise. It's as the old adage says, motion causes friction. Some of those problems come from unforeseen difficulties. Others come from people and their objections. People inevitably exaggerate about the joys of the past, saying it was so much better back then, even if it wasn't. And they complain about the pain of the present as if life were supposed to be conflict-free, and it's not. And they fixate all of their fears on the future, when the future isn't promised to us. But these reactions are perfectly natural. I used to make the mistake of taking personally people's resistance to changing or pushing toward progress. People would push back, and I'd wonder, why can't they see it? Why don't they trust me? Can't we just get on with it? I had to coach myself to remember that it wasn't personal. Besides, leading change is already difficult enough without complicating it with unwanted emotions. The best solution to solving problems is to be productive on the front end by anticipating the worst-case scenarios. In other words, think the worst first. What possibly can go wrong? Spend time running through every possibility you can think of and enlist other leaders to help you be prepared. Speak to the worst first. Let people know that you know how they feel and what they think. And if you discover problems, acknowledge them. Many times people's greatest worry is that they know more than their leaders do, and their leaders aren't prepared to work on the problems. When you assure people that you know what's happening, and you're working on it, you give them a sense of security. Answer the worst first. When people start asking questions and express their worries and concerns, don't avoid the discussions or paint a rosy picture. Give answers. Encourage them through the worst first. People desire the encouragement of their leaders. If you let people know you're in it together and that you need them, they are likely to want to work with you. Even the most highly proactive leaders who work to be out ahead of the problems still encounter unanticipated difficulties. But if you possess a mindset in which you expect problems and you're proactive, you've done all you can do to give the needed changes a chance to succeed. Always point to the successes. In their book, Change is Good, You Go First, Mac Anderson and Tom Feltenstein wrote about the importance of communicating positive reinforcement. I'm sure you've heard the three keys to purchasing real estate: location, location, location. Well, now you'll hear the three keys to inspiring change: reinforce, reinforce, reinforce. Many leaders in times of change grossly underestimate the need for continuous reinforcement. In a perfect world, we would hear something once recorded in our brain and never need to hear it again. But in reality, our words are far from perfect. And during a time of change, we have doubts, fears, occasional disappointments. Sometimes there are friends, family, and co-workers reinforcing those doubts, saying, it won't work. With all the challenges, obstacles, conflict, and naysayers working against people's efforts to implement change, we as leaders need to encourage our people to keep going and keep doing the right things. One of the best ways we can do that is to celebrate their successes, both large and small. One of my idols, John Wooden, the highly successful coach of the UCLA basketball team, always emphasized the team aspect of the game. Anytime a player received a good pass, allowing him to score, Wooden used to encourage the player who received the pass to point to the player who threw it to him to share the credit. It's been said that when one of Coach Wooden's players asks, "Coach, what happens if I point to a player who gave me an assist and he isn't watching?" Coach Wooden replied, "He will always be watching." People desire validation and encouragement. It's just human nature. Positive reinforcement of the successes people experience as they champion change continually validates the changes they make. So point to the good things about the change and point to the people who made them happen. And finally, the letter D in plan ahead. Daily review your progress. This last step in the plan ahead process is vital for two reasons. First, it prompts you to make sure you are on track and moving forward. Second, it reminds you to keep communicating the message of change to your people. That's always a challenge because until the change becomes part of the organization's or team's culture, people lose sight of it and go back to their old way of doing things. Winston Churchill quipped, "To improve is to change, so to be perfect is to have changed often." Certainly, we can't achieve perfection, but we can try to get as close as we can, and that means changing daily. As you work to keep the change message of progress alive with your people, talk about the change clearly, talk about the change creatively, talk about the change continually. If you do that along with your daily review of progress, the change will be lived, experienced, valued, and shared. The final word is credibility. In the end, your ability to create positive change will depend on whether the people you lead buy into you as a leader. The law of buy-in from the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership states, people buy into the leader, then the vision. The foundation of that belief is built through integrity, which we talked about in the previous chapter. Often leaders talk to me about a vision they have for their organization that involves change. They summarize their vision and ask, "Do you think my people will buy into my vision?" My response is, "Have they bought into you as a leader?" That's the question that must be answered before the leader tries to implement change. Credibility creates authority, and that comes from everything we've talked about up to this point: influence, priorities, and integrity. If your people buy into you, then they will want what you want, because they trust you, and they will align with your vision even if it requires change. That is what enables you to do big things, even turn an organization around, like Lou Holtz has. Developing the change agent within you. If you're currently leading a team, department, or organization, there are undoubtedly things you would like to change and improve. Use this chapter's application guide to help you plan the process. How much change do you have as a leader? Before you start the process of planning changes, take some time to figure out where you stand with your people. What is your current level of leadership credibility? How much change do you have in your pocket? Have you earned the credibility to make the change you desire? If you have a difficult time making that judgment, ask the advice of a colleague whose leadership discernment you respect. Start to plan ahead today. Use the plan described in this chapter to prepare for the change that you desire to make. Describe what you will need to do at each stage. Then follow the plan as you roll out the change. Predetermine the change that is needed. Describe in detail the change needed and why it's necessary. Lay out your steps. Write all the steps that will be needed to complete the change. Start by stating where you are now, and outline the logical process step by step needed to get to your ending point. This may take you a significant amount of time. Adjust your priorities. What priorities must be changed to align the organization and the people to the coming change? Notify key people. Who are the key people you must talk to first? Write two lists, the influencers and the implementers. Allow time for acceptance. This will be hard to gauge in advance. Plan time for people to process the issues, and then use your eyes, ears, and intuition to judge when the people have had enough time to get on board. Head into action. Describe what the first steps will look like and how they will impact the team or organization. Expect problems. Describe the most likely problems you will face as the change is implemented. Always point to the successes. Begin planning ways to give recognition and celebrate milestones as the change occurs. Daily review your progress. Describe the method you will use to review the progress of the change. What metrics will you use? Which people will you talk to regularly to assess morale? What specific information will signal that the change has been successfully completed? Chapter 5. The Quickest Way to Gain Leadership. Problem Solving. Many years ago, when I read M. Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, it changed my life. The first pages of the book shook me out of my innate desire for life to be easy, for things to always come my way. Peck wrote, "This is a great truth, one of the greatest truths. It is a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it has been accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters. Most do not fully see this truth that life is difficult. Instead, they moan more or less incessantly, noisily, or subtly, about the enormity of their problems, their burdens, and their difficulties, as if life were generally easy, as if life should be easy. It's true that life is hard for everyone. And if life is tough for individuals, its difficulty is multiplied for leaders. Individuals can thank me, but leaders must thank we. A leader's life is not his or her own. Thanking we means other people are included, and that means their problems also are yours to deal with. On top of that, in a well-led organization, problems are solved at the lowest level possible. That means that the problems that do rise up to leaders are often the most difficult. They are too hot to handle, so they land on the leader's desk. There are seldom two consecutive problem-free days in a leader's life. Most leaders are either entering a crisis, in the middle of a crisis, or just resolving one. Maybe that's why, when asked what is life, a group of psychiatrists at a convention answered, "Life is stress, and you'd better like it." This chapter is my positive take on solving the problems that make leadership so challenging. I hope that this simple practical advice helps you step up and gain credibility in the quickest way as a leader. What does it mean to be pragmatic? As my CEO, Mark Cole, recently reminded me, pragmatism allows a person to take things that others would consider problems or distractions and see them as opportunities. Problems don't have to be problems unless you allow them to be. Why do I say that? Because they do hold potential benefits, which is why problem solving is the quickest way to gain leadership. Problems introduce us to ourselves, problems introduce us to others, and problems introduce us to opportunities. I want to spend the time in this chapter to help you understand and embrace these principles so that you can become a better problem solver. First of all, problems introduce us to ourselves. I've shared some of my early leadership journey, including the 3 years I spent in my first leadership role, where I learned about position, the lowest level of influence in the 5 levels of leadership. Like any other leader, as soon as I stepped into the leadership role, I was confronted with problems. And facing those problems caused me to meet myself as a young, developing leader. Here are the 6 biggest lessons that I learned. Number 1, our decisions are often impacted by our proximity to the problem. Years ago, I heard that when spacecraft were being developed for the Apollo missions, a rift developed between the scientists and the engineers at NASA. Knowing that weight and space were limited, the scientist insisted that every available ounce of weight should be reserved for scientific equipment that could be used to explore and report on the astronauts' experiences in space. The goal, the scientist proclaimed, should be to design a space vessel that would be free from all defects, that would leave a large proportion of the space and weight for scientific equipment. The engineers argued that perfection was an impossible goal. They contended that the only safe assumption was that something would go wrong, but they argued that they could not predict with certainty where the malfunction would occur. Their solution was to build in a series of backup systems to compensate for every possible malfunction. Unfortunately, that would reduce the available space for scientific equipment. Supposedly, the conflict was resolved when the astronauts were asked to weigh in with their opinions. They all voted in favor of the backup systems, not surprising since they were the ones who would be stranded in space if something went wrong. As a leader, the more disconnected you are from your people, the more disconnected you may become from the problems. If that happens, you may lose the human touch in your leadership. As a young leader, I began to understand this and determined to stay close to the people I was leading. Instead of staying in my office, I went to where the people were and walked slowly through the crowd. I wanted what affected them to affect me so that we would make good decisions. Number two, our plates as leaders will always be filled with problems. Early in my leadership career, a dairy farmer told me, "John, the hardest thing about milking cows is that they never stay milked. As a leader, I feel that problems are like cows. You're never really done with them. There are days when I feel like the guy who had four out-of-state client calls scheduled at home before breakfast. Every call revealed a problem, and every client he talked to wanted him to get on a plane right away and come and help them. He skipped breakfast and rushed out of the house as fast as he could, but when he stepped into the garage, he discovered his car wouldn't start. So he called a taxi, and while he was waiting for the taxi, he got another call about yet another problem. When the taxi finally arrived, he dove into the back seat and said, 'Let's go.' 'Where do you want me to take you?' the driver asked. 'It doesn't matter,' he said. 'I've got problems everywhere.' Someone said, 'If you can smile whenever anything goes wrong, you are either a nitwit or a repairman.' Well, I'd say you're probably a leader in the making, because that is the life of a leader. Problems are what you deal with every day, and expecting anything other than that is just being unrealistic. So if you're a leader, don't be surprised when problems arise, and it's your responsibility to solve them. Number three, pragmatism serves us well as leaders. As a young leader in my first position, I was bombarded with problems and called to make decisions. Because there were so many to tackle and I had no staff, I started seeking solutions through trial and error. With every problem, I sought to discover what worked and what didn't. My experimentation with problem solving trained me to be very pragmatic, and my approach enabled me to lead with a patience, persistence mindset. Because I didn't always know the best answers, I had to be patient to figure them out. The benefit of that patience was that I was beginning to develop wisdom. When I was successful, it fueled my persistence, and I kept getting better at problem-solving and decision-making. Over the years, my approach to problem-solving has evolved. I have become aware of my strengths, which is strategy, limitations, which is impatience, and emotions, which is confidence. The result is I've had to let go of my need to be right and focus on the greater need to do right. And I try to keep in mind something author Jim Collins said. There is a sense of exhilaration that comes from facing head-on the hard truths and saying, we will not give up, we will never capitulate. It might take a long time, but we will find a way to prevail. Believing there is always an answer is an asset. Perhaps the most important problem-solving skill that I have learned and practiced over the years is mental agility. I'm always looking for answers. I always believe I can find them, and I'm always convinced that there's more than one solution to any problem. I found that when good leaders are in problem-solving mode, It is as if they are looking at and solving two puzzles at the same time. The first puzzle is the immediate problem, the situation that needs to be resolved right now. They work on that. But at the same time, they also look at the puzzle of the big picture, of their organization, of the industry, of trends. They look at how the small problem relates to the bigger picture and all of its complex pieces. The big picture puzzle may never be completed because it's constantly changing. It has too many pieces to count. But good leaders solve the small puzzle while being informed by the context of the big one. That requires mental agility. Here's how I like to think mental agility works for a leader. When you have it, you're able to move from one puzzle to the other without being distracted. Hold a piece of the puzzle in your mind for weeks or longer with the belief that it will fit somewhere at the appropriate time. Allow the big picture to influence the small one and at the same time give priority and respect to the small one. And finally, live with the tension of two opposing forces. The precision needed to solve the problem and the fluidity to determine when to take those steps. To tap into mental agility, you need to believe you can solve problems. In the 1970s, psychologist Martin Fishbein developed the expectancy value theory of motivation, which says that people's behavior is determined by how highly the goal they have is valued and how strongly they believe they can succeed in achieving it. That means if you believe you can find answers to problems you think are worth solving, you're more motivated to keep working at them. And the more you work at them and succeed, the greater the number of tools you will develop in problem solving. Thus, you will create a positive cycle of success. Number five, our actions can make our problems increase in number and size. So far, most of what I've shared about the lessons I've learned and self-discoveries I've made while solving problems has been positive. But believe me, I've made many errors during my trial and error process. Sometimes those errors not only failed to solve the problems, but made them worse. My problems always tended to multiply when I lost my perspective, gave up on an important personal value, lost my sense of humor, felt sorry for myself, blamed others for my situation, or wished for them to go away instead of working for them to go away. Through these errors, I learned that I needed to take responsibility for addressing the problem, take responsibility for my attitude and emotions, and give my best effort to landing a solution that was good for my team and my organization. Number six, problems handled well often make us better. And that leads me to the final thing I learned about myself. When I didn't give up and I did the right thing in the face of the problem, even if I had not initially handled it well, the experience made me a better person and a better leader. The bang-ups and the hang-ups of life have a way of humbling us. When I was a new leader, I used to think, I wish life were easier. But over time, as I continually faced problems, because they weren't going away, I started to experience a shift in my mindset. And I began to think to myself, I wish I were better. I call that the problem promise. When you handle them well, problems promise to make you better. Years ago, I read that many of the significant accomplishments in human history occurred in the face of problems. Florence Nightingale, too ill to move from her bed, reorganized the hospitals of England. Semi-paralyzed and under constant menace of apoplexy, Pasteur was tireless in his attack on disease. During the greater part of his life, American historian Francis Parkman suffered so acutely that he could not work more than 5 minutes at a time. His eyesight was so wretched that he could scrawl only a few gigantic words on a manuscript, but he contrived to write 12 magnificent volumes of history. And I know from my studies of the Bible that the Psalms were written in the face of adversity, and most of the letters in the New Testament were written from jail. When leaders of good character face problems, they rise to the occasion and are often defined by the response. Bury a person in the snows of Valley Forge, and you have George Washington. Raise him in abject poverty, and you have Abraham Lincoln. Strike him down with paralysis, and he becomes Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Burn him so severely that the doctors say he'll never walk again, and you have Glenn Cunningham, who set the world record for running a mile in 1934. Oppress them in a society filled with racial discrimination, and they become a Booker T. Washington, a Marian Anderson, a George Washington Carver, a Martin Luther King Jr. Call him retarded and write him off as uneducable, and you have an Albert Einstein. Problems don't have to break us. They can instead make us. When we are tempted to avoid problems and responsibilities because they seem too weighty, just remember the youth who asked his mentor, "What's life's heaviest burden?" The response, "Having nothing to carry." What you face helps you to face yourself, and what you're able to carry defines you. Secondly, problems introduce us to others. I recently asked a friend about the character of an acquaintance of ours whom neither of us knew very well. His reply, "I'm not able to comment on his character. I've never seen him handle adversity." And I thought, how true. You can learn a lot about yourself by the way you deal with problems, but you can learn also a lot about other people based on how they react. If you're a leader, that information is critical. People's responses to problems and adversity impact the chemistry of your team and the outcome of their efforts. People who make problems worse. When some people face a problem, they can make it worse. I used to tell my staff that all people in an organization carry with them two buckets. One is filled with gasoline, the other with water. When they come across a spark of a problem, they choose which bucket to use on it. Will they dump gasoline on the spark and create a real fire, or will they throw water on it and put it out? How do the people around you react to the sparks of life? Are they fire lighters who blow things up, or are they firefighters who calm things down? Anyone who enjoys throwing gasoline on the fire is a liability to you and the organization. People who become problem magnets. When you have people who focus on problems, collect them, or multiply them, they also tend to attract other problem seekers. It's an example of the law of magnetism from the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. Who you are is who you attract. Such people often eventually become the problem. If you're someone who sees nothing but problems, guess what you'll get in life? More problems. If you see nothing but possibilities, guess what? You receive more possibilities. The first law of wholes says, when you are in one, stop digging. As a leader, can you help someone to stop being a problem magnet? Can you take the shovel away from him and stop him from digging his own grave professionally? The answer is yes, but the person has to want to change and may need a lot of support to change the way he thinks. People who give up in face of problems. Many years ago, I hired a new executive assistant. Her name was Barbara Brummerchen. She had been my assistant only a few weeks when I asked her to find a phone number for someone I wanted to contact. Within a few moments, Barbara returned to my office and told me she couldn't find the number. She had given up in the face of a problem. I sensed that this had the potential to set the tone for our relationship. So I said, "Barbara, bring me the Rolodex that was in the days before Google and the Internet, and then come sit down next to me." I thought for a moment, then started flipping through the phone numbers in the Rolodex until I found a starting point. Then I began making calls. I don't remember how many people I had to call chasing down the train until I talked to someone who could give me the number, but I think it took me about 45 minutes. When I finally got the number, I wrote it down, handed it to Barbara so that she could put it in the Rolodex. "There's always a way to solve a problem if you don't give up," I told her. Then I made my call. Barbara later shared with me that she learned three things that day. First, there is always an answer. Second, the answer is not always easy to find. And third, she was determined never to dump a problem back on my desk. Rather, she would deliver the answer. Barbara was willing to change, and that day she went from being a problem spotter to a problem solver. She took responsibility for finding solutions. People who use problems as stepping stones for success. In their book titled Cradles of Eminence, Victor and Mildred Gortzel wrote about their study of the backgrounds of more than 400 highly successful men and women who would be recognized as brilliant in their fields. The list included Franklin D. Roosevelt, Helen Keller, Winston Churchill, Albert Schweitzer, Clara Barton, Mahatma Gandhi, Albert Einstein, and Sigmund Freud. The intensive investigation into the early home lives yielded some startling findings. Three-fourths of them, as children, were troubled by poverty, broken homes, or difficult parents who were rejecting, overly possessive, or domineering. 74 of the 85 writers of fiction or drama surveyed, and 16 of the 20 poets came from homes where they saw tense psychological drama played out between their parents. More than one-fourth of the sample suffered physical handicaps, such as blindness, deafness, and other crippling disabilities. Why did these achievers overcome problems while many others are overwhelmed by theirs? They didn't see their problems as stumbling blocks. They were spurred on by problems and used them as stepping stones. They understood that problem solving was a choice, not a function of circumstance. As a leader, you need to pay attention to how your people respond to problems, and you need to help them respond correctly if possible. What does that take? Time. Time to begin with. You need to observe people up close as they encounter problems to see how they respond. And you need to spend time helping them learn to deal with problems positively. You can't solve problems for them. If you do, you'll be forever solving their problems. You must solve problems with them, or at least until they can get the hang of it. Once they start to see how you approach problems and begin to take a similar approach, ask them to consult with you before they deal with anything major, and ask if they bring three possible solutions with them when they present the problem to you. If all the solutions are bad, ask them to come back with more options. If all the solutions are great, ask them which one they would pick and why. If only one of the solutions is good, ask them which of the three they would pick and why. If they pick the right one, affirm them. If they pick the wrong one, use it as a teaching moment. The day before John F. Kennedy was inaugurated as President of the United States, outgoing President Dwight D. Eisenhower shared some wisdom with him. "You'll find no easy problems ever come to the President of the United States," said Eisenhower. "If they're easy to solve, somebody else has solved them." That may be true at the presidential level, but it is only true in other organizations if employees are encouraged to solve problems at the lowest level possible, and if they have been equipped and empowered to deal with problems and make decisions. If small problems keep getting sent up to you, then you're creating a problem for yourself by not helping your people to be better problem solvers. Finally, problems introduce us to opportunities. Albert Einstein said, "In the middle of difficulty lies opportunity." Not everyone sees things this way, but any leader who can shift his or her thinking from "is there an answer" to "there is always an answer" to "there must be a good answer" has the potential to become not only a fantastic problem solver, but also a change agent for opportunity. Leadership author and speaker Glenn Lopez has written about the power of this problem-solving perspective. He quoted Karl Popper, "All life is problem-solving." Then he went on to say, "The best leaders are the best problem-solvers. They have the patience to step back and see the problem at hand through broadened observation. The most effective leaders approach problems through the lens of opportunity." So how do you look at problems through the lens of opportunity? I recommend that you begin by doing these eight things. Number one, recognize a potential problem before it becomes a real problem. Great leaders are seldom blindsided. Like boxers, they recognize that the punch that knocks them out is usually the one they didn't see coming. For that reason, they are always looking for signs and indicators that will give them insight into any potential problems ahead. Every problem is like the one faced by the trespasser at an Indiana farm who saw a sign on the fence post that said, "If you can cross this field, you'd better do it in 9.8 seconds. The bull can do it in 10 seconds. Great leaders anticipate problems so they can position themselves and their team for success. What potential problems do you see in your world, and what is your game plan to fix them when they happen? Downsides rarely have an upside unless you're ready for them on the front end. Number two, get a clear picture of the problem. Have you ever heard the saying, assumption is the mother of all mess-ups? There's also a less polite version of this. If assumptions create mess-ups in everyday life, they create train wrecks in leadership. The place to start is by getting a clear picture of the problem you face. Financier and business titan J.P. Morgan asserted, "No problem can be solved until it's reduced to some simple form. The changing of a vague difficulty into a specific concrete form is a very essential element in thinking. That process begins by identifying what constitutes a problem." My friend Bob Beale, who has given me wonderful advice over the years, once told me, "A decision is a choice you make between two or more alternatives. A problem is a situation that's counter to your intentions or expectations. So what must you do when you find yourself facing one of those counter situations?" Follow the advice of author Max Dupree, who said, "The first responsibility of a leader is to define reality." As a natural optimist, I often have a hard time with this. I'm like the guy who went to see the doctor because he was having some trouble. The doctor ordered x-rays, which revealed a serious problem. "You're going to need surgery," the doctor advised. "Is it serious?" the man asked. "It's going to be highly painful and very expensive." "In that case," the man replied, "couldn't you just touch up the x-rays?" Failing to see a clear picture of the problem or refusing to face reality doesn't help you solve a problem. My brother Larry, who has been a consistent mentor to me for many years, especially in business and financial decisions, often reminds me of this. After a bad year for one of my companies, I was sharing with Larry how I hoped the next year would be better. With a clearer picture than I possessed at the time, Larry said, "John, hope isn't enough. Face reality and let your first loss become your last loss." Larry was exhorting me not to rationalize my situation or justify any bad choices I'd made. You can't solve problems and make progress without having a clear picture of the situation and then taking appropriate steps forward. Otherwise, you risk doing what my friend author Harvey McKay calls watering the weeds. Number three, ask questions to help you solve problems. Okay, I have to admit that I love questions. Not only do they help me gather information and seek solutions, but they also enable me to understand what people think and feel before I lead them. I think most leaders are too quick to talk and lead and too slow to ask questions and listen. Here's a series of questions I hope will help you to problem solve and solution implement. The information question: who knows the most about this problem? One of the mistakes confident leaders sometimes make is starting to solve problems before they have enough information. They jump to conclusions. Instead, one of the best things you can do as a leader is to talk to the people closest to the problem to hear their observations and suggestions. They may already know what needs to be done and only lack the resources and permission to solve the problem. The experience question: who knows what I need to know? Playwright Ben Jonson said, "He that is taught only by himself has a fool for a mentor." If you are your only source of information and ideas, you're in trouble. Who do you know who can help you, advise you, mentor you? Author Jim Collins calls this HULUP. If you know great people who can help you, you have it. The more HULUP you have, the faster you can solve many problems. The challenge question: who wants to tackle this problem? Who can do this, we ask. Well, that's a good question, but a better question is, who wants to do this? Dealing with problems requires energy. The person with desire is less likely to get worn down by the problem. Capacity alone is not enough. The tendency when solving problems is to look first at the capacity of people on our team. Who? The magnitude question, who needs to buy in and how long will that take? So much of problem solving in leadership is gauging where your people are, what your people feel, and whether they are ready to go somewhere with you. As you think about solutions to problems, you need to ask yourself questions. How big an issue is this? How will people's work be impacted? How will it affect their lives? The larger the impact, the greater the repercussions and the bigger the decisions, the more buy-in you need people to have. People will buy in more readily when they have had more input into the decision-making, even if the solution isn't the one that they would have suggested themselves. The trust question. Have we earned enough trust to make the needed changes? This is one of the most critical questions you can ask when preparing to initiate changes. When trust within the team or organization is high, we can make more changes without negative fallout. If trust is low, our leadership is limited, and we can make relatively few changes before people begin to resist. That means that even if you have great solutions, you could fail to solve the problem if people haven't bought in. People won't accept change if they don't trust you. The personal question. What questions do I need to ask myself? The final question is a check to make sure you're on track. As a leader, I continually take my own temperature as I deal with problems. I ask myself, what do I feel? This reveals my emotions. What do I think? This stimulates my best thinking. What do I know? This draws out of my experience. I never want to blindly move forward in problem solving without including personal reflection. Do you have a process for self-examination reflection related to problem solving? You don't want to rely on knee-jerk solutions. Good leaders don't just resolve the issue to get it off their plates quickly for the sake of their own comfort. They help create solutions that take their people and their organization forward and put them in a better position than they were in before they experienced the problem. That's what you're shooting for. Number 4, create a framework to examine problems and solutions. Once you know you have a problem and you work to get a clear picture of it, you can start to gather information. But whatever data you collect will help you only if you have a framework for judging what you will find out. Otherwise, how will you interpret what you discover? My framework has 6 critical keys. Leadership. How does this problem affect our people? Personnel. Do we have the right people to help us with this problem? Timing. Is this the right time for a solution? And do we have enough time for it? Vision. How does this problem affect where we are trying to go? Priorities. Are my problems taking me or my team away from our priorities? Values. Are my values or my team's being compromised by this problem? Problems can very easily cause us to lose our way or take our eye off the ball. Often the big picture gets obscured while we deal with the emotion and disruption problem causes. My framework helps me maintain proper perspective. I encourage you to develop a framework of your own to keep from being put off track. Number 5. Value shared problem solving. The best problem solvers don't work alone. They enlist the aid of other thinkers to help them, and they use the Socratic method of asking questions to gain from other people's thinking. This method helps them become better problem-solving leaders. I wish I had learned this earlier in my leadership career. I did my problem-solving solo. I was too insecure to ask for help, and I spent 90% of my time working on the solution alone, and then asked for input on the last 10%. The reality is I wanted the applause of others more than I wanted their assistance. Today, my problem-solving method follows a 10-80-10 pattern, where I try to do the first and the last 10% of the problem solving and have others contribute 80% in the middle. The first 10% is often focused on defining the problem for all of us. The next 80% of my time and effort is spent in listening to my team's ideas and facilitating their thinking. The last 10% is my attempt to add value from a leadership perspective. I call this putting the cherry on the top. I can't always improve the solutions that my team comes up with, but I try. Obviously, the key to this approach is having an environment in which people are willing to share their ideas and offer their opinions. If you don't have that, then shared problem solving doesn't work very well. But the good news is that you can foster this kind of environment by doing the following things. Remove silos. Glenn Lopez asserts organizational silos are the root cause of most workplace problems and are why many of them never get resolved. Breaking down silos allows a leader to more easily engage their employees to get their hands dirty and solve problems together. It becomes less about corporate politicking and more about finding resolutions and making the organization stronger. A great illustration of breaking silos down is the Richards Group, an agency of advertising in Dallas, Texas. Stan Richards shared with me and took me through his facility and showed me how they did this literally, physically. Stan has all of his people work in open space. No walls, no doors, nothing to keep them separated from others. Even Stan's office has neither doors nor walls. And when he wants to update people on company business, within 5 minutes, he can have all 600 people gathered for what he calls a stairwell meeting, where people on all three floors can see one another from the open stairway and adjoining balconies. It's astounding. If you want people to openly assist in problem solving, you have to get rid of the silos. People who want to increase their territory and protect their turf are rarely willing to freely offer ideas that will benefit anyone other than themselves and their team or their department. Create a speak-up environment. When people are asked to share their problems or to offer ideas for their organization, what happens? People become silent? Do they withdraw? Do they avoid eye contact and try to keep a low profile? If so, you're not working in a speak-up environment. As a leader, you need to work to change that. In a speak-up environment, comments are welcome. Participation is encouraged, and good ideas are rewarded. People don't feel as though their jobs are in jeopardy every time they share a problem, and they don't feel as if they will be discounted or disrespected any time they share a bad idea. To foster this kind of an environment, you need to promote an atmosphere where the best idea always wins. If people are encouraged to share any idea, they learn that many ideas lead to good ideas, and many good ideas lead to great ideas. Here are some of the things to keep in mind as you encourage your people to speak up. Never promote the belief that you always have the best answers. This will make others dependent on you and less likely to speak up. Ask questions. I know I've mentioned this before, but it's one of the most important things you can do. By asking a series of questions, you can help people analyze a problem, and think through an entire solution. Try to be a coach, not a king. A coach brings out the best in others, helping them reach deep down inside and discover their potential. A king gives commands. Remember, the best leaders help others see and solve problems without them. Socialize ideas. I like what Linux International's Paul Larkin calls socializing ideas. It's a strategy in which leaders share their ideas informally throughout the normal course of the day to gain acceptance for them before formally implementing them. In this way, your people are not blindsided. They have the opportunity to mull over ideas, and they have enough time to improve the ideas. When they do that, buy-in increases dramatically. Number 6, always come up with more than one solution. For years, I was a very limited problem solver. I would find one answer for a problem, and then I would champion that solution to my people. Today, I try to be more creative and look for many solutions and let the best one champion itself. Yesterday's approach states, Settle for the first solution. Focus on only the problem. Fear uncertainty. Conform to the rules. Possess a narrow view. Fear taking risk and have limited choices. In contrast, today's approach states, pursue multiple solutions. Explore all opportunities. Embrace ambiguity. Celebrate the creative. Connect the unconnected. Don't fear failing and enjoy many options. As you seek to solve problems, list as many solutions to a problem as possible. The more the better. Keep in mind that seldom is there just one way to solve a problem. The more options, the better, because problems continually shift and change. Leaders who don't have backup solutions soon find themselves in trouble. As you grow as a problem-solving leader, you'll begin to see a progression in your thinking that might look something like this. There is no answer. There could be an answer. I have an idea. There is an answer. There could be more answers. I have more ideas. There are more answers. There are better ideas. The truth is that big ideas don't appear, they evolve. But that only happens when you're determined to explore ideas and look for more and better solutions. Number 7, cultivate a bias for action. One of the greatest dangers for a thoughtful person is to spend too much time on problem solving and too little time on solution implementing. Leaders who don't or can't follow through are in danger of thinking, ready, aim, 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 but they never fire. The solution is to develop a bias for action. Don't think, can I? Instead think, how can I? Then start moving forward. The moment you confront and act on a problem, you begin to solve it. If great inventors and explorers hadn't taken tangible, deliberate steps forward, would they have ever made the contributions they're known for? No. Their belief prompted action, and their action created results. Ideas evolve as you move, and better solutions come into view as you move forward. Ultimately, you can't wish or wait your way through difficulties. You must work your way through them. Number 8, actively look for opportunities and lessons in every problem. President John F. Kennedy was once asked how he became a war hero. With his customary dry wit, Kennedy replied, "Oh, it was quite easy. Somebody sunk my boat." That is the essence of seeing opportunity in the midst of a problem. No matter how difficult your circumstances may seem, there is likely a solution that not only resolves a problem, but has the potential to improve your life and your leadership. This has been true repeatedly in my life. As a young pastor in my first church in Indiana, I looked for some resources that would help me teach my congregation how to best manage their lives. After days of searching bookstores and libraries, I found nothing. That problem forced me to find a different solution. That's when I decided to develop my own ideas and use them to teach my people. I did, and my solution was successful. That planted the seed that eventually grew in me, prompting me to write my first book. Then another, and another. Today I look back and I see more than 100 books selling more than 28 million copies in more than 50 languages. What a legacy. I never anticipated or thought possible when I was simply trying to solve a problem at the age of 23. Another problem that shaped my life came as the result of my leadership after I left my first leadership position. Under my direction, the church had grown to 300 people, but within 6 months of my departure, attendance had fallen below 100. For months, I racked my brain to figure out what had happened. And then it finally occurred to me, I had trained and equipped no one. As soon as I wasn't present to be the catalyst, everything fell apart. From the moment of that realization, I decided to make equipping and developing people a priority. I spent the 45 years since then dedicated to that task, and that journey came to fruition on June 26, 2015, when I taught leadership to leaders from Kiribati in Fiji for EQUIP, my nonprofit organization. That was the day we completed our training of leaders from every country of the world, in total 6 million leaders. And it all started because of my failure in my first leadership position and the lessons that I learned from it. My speaking style also came to be because of a problem I experienced. When I was in my 30s, I threw out my back playing racquetball. For 3 days, I couldn't get out of bed. And the following day, I could only stand for a couple of minutes at a time. The next week, I was